September 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is asked about racial injustice on a visit Tuesday to Kenosha, Wisconsin, the latest U.S. city with violence and unrest.
These are not acts of peaceful protest, but really domestic terror.
Belarus's opposition leader rejects Western help.
This political crisis that takes place in our country is a totally internal affair.
Also ahead, a new normal for school kids in Uganda, thanks to COVID-19. It's all on today's International Edition. Days after Jacob Blake's shooting by police, President Trump toured Kenosha, Wisconsin Tuesday, injecting himself into the latest episode of racial unrest in America. It's the latest site of violent protests triggered by the shooting of a black man by a white police officer last month, as the president pushes his campaign message of law and order. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Local and state leaders asked him to stay away, but the president visited an area charred by fire after days of protests.
These are not acts of peaceful protest, but really domestic terror.
Again, blaming Democrats for inciting anti-police rhetoric, and again, denying structural racism exists in America after a series of police-involved shootings of black Americans.
I don't believe that.
Asked what he'd say to Blake's family.
I feel terribly for anybody that goes through that.
The president did not meet with the family, and Blake's uncle Justin says that's fine.
We don't have any words for the orange man. All I ask is that, he keep his disrespect, his foul language far away from our family.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
On Monday, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden gave a blistering speech on Trump's law and order strategy.
He can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it. You know, he may believe mouthing the words law and order makes him strong, but his failure to call on his own supporters to stop acting as an armed militia in this country shows how weak he is.
Trump has continued to amplify his message that violence in American cities will get worse with the Joe Biden presidency. The death in U.S. police custody of George Floyd, a black man, sparked widespread protest for racial and social justice and brought views of fairness into stark contrast in America's melting pot. Recently, a panel of former national security professionals explored the role that race and racism play in office, diplomatic, and security practices and what might be done to improve things. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Anne Marie Slaughter moderated the online discussion. A one-time director of policy planning for the U.S. State Department, she is CEO of New America, the Washington-based think tank that organized the event.
Our mission is renewing the promise of America by continuing the quest to live up to our highest ideals. And that, in many ways, is what this moment is about. The complete exposure of the gap between who we are and who we say we are and who we want to be, but we are manifestly not. How do we address that as a national security community? What needs to change?
Michelle Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under President Barack Obama. In her view, real change won't begin until more diversity of race, of gender, of ethnic group is represented in the corridors of power. At this time, that goal seems distant for African Americans. 93% of top U.S. federal officials are white. Among the 41 most senior military commanders, only two are black. And while blacks make up nearly 15% of America's workforce, only 6% are in the career foreign service. Flournoy says that is a tragic waste of talent. She recalls that in the Obama White House, a wide, even unorthodox range of views and backgrounds was welcomed.
Someone comes in with a dissenting view. Someone questions the assumption that groupthink is starting to form around. Just that diversity of perspective that consistently, I think, helped the president make better decisions.
Co-panelist Camille Stewart is a national security and foreign policy expert at New America with family roots in Jamaica and more distantly in Africa. She says it's crucial to include the voices of diasporans and immigrants when formulating policy. She notes that many have been on the receiving end of European and American foreign policy decisions.
The perspectives of particularly diaspora and immigrant communities reflect living through colonialism in a very real way, and the understanding of how race underpins many of our development and aid decisions, and how those things then impact these communities, and how those things then tie into our defense and our security. But we cannot ignore the fact that the system is not built for everyone and should be.
American public diplomacy through government media can be crucial in helping people abroad forge an emotional connection to the U.S. for good or sometimes bad. For example, when people abroad see racial and social injustice in the U.S., it undercuts America's ability to credibly promote human rights and democracy on the world stage. Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins is founder and president of the nonprofit group Women of Color Advancing Peace, Security, and Conflict Transformation. She says America must look in the mirror.
Do we really know it all? Are we the best people to go around the world and dictate how things should be when we have so many questions at home? We do have a lot of problems. We see them, but we try to ignore them. Let's be honest about it, how we have been in other countries, how we have treated other countries, how we treat them, and how we treat ourselves, and look at that as a package. Who are we really? Who do we want to be? And do we have the courage to ask that question?
The soul searching continues. On August 23rd, another black man was shot by police and paralyzed from the waist down, prompting further protests and further heating the flashpoint in the presidential campaign. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
A senior State Department official on condition of anonymity says the U.S. is considering imposing sanctions on seven Belarusians it believes were involved in falsifying the results of the August 9th election and in violence against peaceful protesters. Protests erupted after an outcry from opposition supporters who say the election was rigged to prolong President Alexander Lukashenko's 26-year rule. Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya tells VOA the country's political crisis is an internal affair, appearing to reject any Western help. In an interview in Vilnius, Lithuania, where she fled after Belarus's disputed election, Tsikhanouskaya said she feared for the fate of the protesters on the streets of Belarus. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Hello. Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya has been thrust into the global spotlight, the figurehead of the Belarusian opposition, a 37-year-old woman standing up to Alexander Lukashenko, known as Europe's last dictator. Yet Tsikhanouskaya told VOA she does not seek international help.
This political crisis that takes place in our country is absolutely internal affair, and we have Belarusian people have responsibility for what's going on, and we think that we have to solve this problem by ourselves.
Their solution so far? People power. Tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets since the August 9th election, demanding the resignation of President Lukashenko. He claimed victory with 80% of the vote. The opposition, along with the United States and the European Union, say the vote was heavily rigged. Hundreds of protesters have been arrested, and there is widespread evidence of abuse and torture. Tsikhanouskaya fled to neighboring Lithuania after the election, fearing for her family's safety, but refused to elaborate further.
I had big reasons to make this step. I can't talk about this now. Maybe somewhere in the future I will talk of them, all my story, but now I can't comment on it.
Now Tsikhanouskaya is trying to coordinate a roadmap for Belarus's future.
First of all, we'll start negotiations when the authorities release all political prisoners who are innocent and still in Belarusian jails. We are fighting for free, fair, and transparent elections, which means that every citizen of Belarus will be able to participate in those elections. A more pertinent question would be whether Mr. Lukashenko has the moral right to participate in the new elections after all those crimes he's committed.
The Kremlin has invited Lukashenko to Moscow in the coming days. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he has a police reserve force ready to intervene in Belarus.
Mr. Putin has to understand that if he does something against us Belarusians, it will seriously damage the relationship between Russian and Belarusian people. And because we are allied nations, we are considered almost brothers. It is not in the interest of either Belarus or Russia.
Одна история и язык и ну вообще мы чуть ли не братья друг друга считаем, то это абсолютно не в интересах как ни Беларуси, ни Беларуси, так и России.
Tikhanouchkaya stood for the presidency after the May arrest of her husband, popular video blogger Sergei Tikhanovsky, who had planned to take part. The wives of other opposition figures offered her their support. Thousands of women have joined the anti-government protests in recent days.
Да, вы знаете, тяжело, потому что хочется быть рядом с ними и.
It's difficult for me because I want to be with them. And you know why? Because I do not fully feel that atmosphere. Observing it from here, it looks scary to me and they seem afraid. But people who are there tell me that they are inspired. We, the women of Belarus, are such a force. I am worried about them, but they are so strong.
Мы такая сила. Мы женщины в Беларуси такая сила. Опасаюсь за них, но не такие смелые.
The protests have drawn comparisons with those in neighboring Ukraine in 2014 that led to the overthrow of President Viktor Yanukovych. Then the colors of the European Union flag filled Independence Square as the opposition courted Western support. Russia responded by annexing Crimea and invading eastern Ukraine. In contrast, Svetlana Tikhanouchkaya has, for now, explicitly rejected any outside intervention. Across the border in her home country, the protesters continue to defy the government. Their future and the political fortunes of Tikhanouchkaya remain highly uncertain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday gave Lebanese politicians until the end of October to start delivering on reforms, saying financial aid would be withheld and sanctions imposed further down the line if corruption gets in the way. Macron told a news conference in Beirut that political leaders had agreed to form a government of experts in the next 2 weeks to help chart a new course for the Middle East nation collapsing under the weight of an economic meltdown and following a massive explosion that leveled parts of the city. Macron's visit came just hours after Lebanese leaders named diplomat Mustafa Adib as the new prime minister on Monday under French pressure. Macron also addressed the Lebanese people in an Arabic language tweet saying he had returned as promised to, quote, work together to create necessary conditions for reconstruction and stability. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy spoke with Joe Macaron, senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, about the French pressure to save Lebanon.
Since the Beirut explosion happened, the French policy felt the need to fill the power vacuum. At the end of the day, Lebanon is one of the last country of influence for France. And there was fear that maybe Iranian or Turkish will fill this vacuum. In particular, given the competition between France and Turkey and the Eastern Mediterranean. So there was this French very clear pressure on the political class in Lebanon after the explosion in Beirut to get their act together and move on with reform. And there was some sort of also U.S. support for this international mandate led by France, as Paris was trying to be a mediator between Washington and Tehran in Lebanese politics. So now there's a follow-up visit to remind the Lebanese leaders what's the benchmark for reform, what's demanded from them, from the international community. But I think at the end of the day, the are not the main player in Lebanese politics, given the influence of the Americans and Iranians, who will eventually set the tone for whatever might happen in the coming weeks and months in Lebanon.
A French presidency source said Macron was demanding a government of mission, clean, efficient, and able to implement necessary reforms in Lebanon. Macron said that the exceptional moment facing Lebanon right now led him to increase pressure. Would his pressure produce a functional, nonpartisan government in Lebanon?
The early indications are not very encouraging. Mustafa Adib, the name prime minister, was basically parachuted to Lebanese politics. He has no experience in public governance at this level. He was named outside of Lebanese institutions without any understanding of the Lebanese public mood at that time. He's a product of the political class. He's one of the public servants who was serving lately as an ambassador in Germany. And he doesn't show any indication that he might be willing or able to lead such a reform. But again, this is the first step. I think the main thing is who the minister he will pick, what kind of platform the government will have, and what it will be able to accomplish. But for now, it's just the remaking of a political class that's trying to cut losses and just get a different face that could lead this unprecedented crisis in Lebanese history.
A spokesperson from the International Monetary Fund said, "We welcome the nomination of a new prime minister in Lebanon and hope that a new government will be formed shortly with a mandate to implement policies and reforms that Lebanon needs to address the current crisis and restore sustainable growth." Is a loan from the IMF enough as a first step to improve the economic situation in Lebanon?
A loan from the IMF alone is not enough. As we have seen in the past few months, the previous government has negotiated with the IMF for months, but the Lebanese team was not unified. There was not transparency in data, and these talks have stalled. So now we have to see what's the approach of the new government. And the history has taught us that an IMF loan without a real economic and or reform plan will backfire and will not be very popular among the citizens, because they will be asked to make large sacrifices. And the Lebanese people believe at this point that they should not alone take this burden. So the question is whether a deep government's form, will it have the willingness and the capability to lead such an ambitious project for Lebanon?
Joe Macaron, senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Facebook says it has uncovered a Russian influence campaign in an operation that was posing as an independent news outlet to target left-wing voters in the United States and Britain, including by recruiting freelance journalists to write about domestic politics and racial tensions in the run-up to the November 3rd presidential election. The owners of four Iranian fuel cargoes that were confiscated by U.S. authorities last month mounted a challenge to the seizures, asserting their rights to control the cargo, according to a court filing Tuesday. The U.S. Justice Department last month announced the seizures of what it said was just over a million barrels of oil in what it said was destined for Venezuela. The oil industries of Venezuela and Iran, both OPEC nations, are under U.S. sanctions. After accompanying an Israeli delegation to the United Arab Emirates for historic normalization talks, White House advisor Jared Kushner set off on a tour of other Gulf capitals Tuesday looking for more Arab support. Israel and the UAE set up a joint committee to cooperate on financial services at the talks in the UAE capital of Abu Dhabi. Botswana says a string of mysterious elephant deaths has come to a halt since June, when at least 281 carcasses were found, raising hopes that the animals are no longer at risk. Experts in the southern African country with the world's largest elephant population are pointing to a natural toxin as the likely cause of the deaths. Mukdisi Dube reports from Gaborone.
Botswana's Minister of Wildlife and Environment, Permanent Secretary Odwetsi Kobodo, says it appears the country's elephants are no longer dying from a mystery cause. While close to 300 elephants carcasses were found earlier this year, with no sign of poaching or predators, the ministry has not found any more since June. Most of the blood samples sent abroad for testing are indicating a toxin as the cause, says Kobodo, though it's not yet clear if it is man-made or natural.
We have received most of the results. A lot of variables that we suspected had tested negative. We have ruled out any virus, no bacteria, pathogens also negative. And the only thing that we are waiting for is toxicology. What is evident is that we are now dealing with a poison.
Kobodo says officials are waiting on one last batch of test results from the United States before making a final conclusion. Veterinarian Dr. Mbachi Mazwiduma says a natural occurring toxin would explain why normal elephants appear to be dying in Botswana's Okavango Panhandle.
In the period leading to June, remember, this is the dry period. The amount of water is in low quantities. Now, because of a naturally occurring toxin, there would be in higher concentrations in the waters, and those elephants that drink in particular spots, they can get affected. Now, with the rising waters of the Okavango in the Panhandle over the last couple of weeks, those toxins are then diluted and washed out.
Conservationist Neil Fitt agrees that changes in weather conditions could have diluted a natural toxin.
If it is an environmental toxin, they come and go depending on weather conditions. So obviously the conditions, if that is the case, have now changed. And, you know, that's the reason why the deaths have stopped, which is a good thing. But until we get the results, which are extremely long in coming, we can't say much more.
The Minister of Wildlife and Environment, Skoboto, says getting quick results on the investigation and test samples was not possible due to COVID-19 restrictions.
There was lockdowns everywhere, even internationally. Mostly we are dependent on air transport. If there are no flights going even outside the country, just even to South Africa here, how could we have taken them out?
Botswana's neighbor, Zimbabwe, recorded mysterious deaths of at least 11 elephants. Wildlife authorities say the cause appears to be a bacterial infection. The two countries have the world's combined largest elephant population at more than 200,000 animals, most of them in Botswana. Conservationists estimate the number of wild African elephants has dropped by almost a third in the last decade due to drought, loss of habitat, and poaching. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London. On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. COVID-19 has created a new normal for school children learning by video applications and broadcast channels, including in Uganda. But while many embrace the new normal, not all families are able to afford paying for the data or even electricity for the television, as Halima Adumani reports from Mukono, Uganda.
14-year-old Ugandan Musa Sewanyana has mastered the art of bricklaying. He should be in high school laying the foundation of his education. But since Uganda closed schools in March to contain the spread of the novel coronavirus, Sewanyana has few options. He says during the school break, he is still reading his books. If we get money, says Sewanyana, we switch the TV on and follow the teachings. But I also do odd jobs, he says, so I don't spend the whole day at home. Unlike families who are financially able to study online, Sewanyana's cannot always afford the power needed to watch lessons on state TV or the $3 per day subscription. His mother, Naiga Rashida, says the past 5 months have been difficult with her three children at home. She says they don't have electricity. She had even bought them a new television set, knowing they would use it to study, says Rashida. But there are times when even the solar battery doesn't charge, she says, and the television goes off. The Ugandan government vowed to buy televisions and radios for poor communities with school children, but has yet to act. A $150 million July World Bank grant is expected soon to help provide learning materials for students nationwide. But Uganda's acting director of basic education, Mulindwa Ismail, says the damage is already done, including to school properties that were sold off or sitting vacant.
The chairs, there were some of them were eaten by ants. So by the time we reopen schools, we may need now to replenish, to buy another set of furniture. But that said, loss of jobs for our teachers and what, losing property, but even losing our learners. We are worried the sizable percentage may not come back to school.
Education charity groups like Uwezo, which means capability in Kiswahili, says COVID-19 has caused both a health and education crisis. When schools eventually reopen, says Uwezo's executive director, Mary Goretti Nakabugo, children will have to make up for lost time.
The starting point would be to try and give a simple assessment to understand the level at which each of these kids is. Otherwise, if you take them as a whole, many of them are going to be left behind. And the ones who are going to be left behind are mainly the ones in the low-income families.
Meanwhile, Uganda's Ministry of Education is planning a campaign aimed at parents to encourage homeschooling. Halima Athmani for VA News, Mukono, Uganda. So
watch me free. BTS fans and music insiders say the band topping the Billboard Hot 100 is both a joyous and historical moment. The band has become the first Korean act to top the chart with their English language single, Dynamite. David Stewart, who produced and co-wrote the hit song, said he was over the moon. South Korea was in a celebratory mood over the news. President Moon Jae-in posted a message on Twitter congratulating the band for their feat. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists.
win prizes, and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.